Welcome to Connect the Dots, a podcast that explores today's most pressing issues and what that means for you, your family, and community. This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. It is supported in part by the Arlie Shart Fund for Climate Justice and the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rob Virchik, your host of Connect the Dots, and I'm excited to introduce you today to a youth activist named Ada Crandall. What started as an after-school environmental project soon became a citywide movement across Portland, Oregon, thanks to Ada's relentless pursuit for change and improvement. I think you'll find her story really inspiring. But before we get to that, it's time for Rob's Rants and Raves. And this time, folks, well, it's a rant. And it starts with three letters. CCS. That stands for carbon capture and storage. It's a kind of a climate change action technology that the oil and gas industry is suddenly super excited about. And there are a lot of politicians in certain states, namely Texas and Louisiana, among others, who are really excited about this too. President Biden is on board. His infrastructure bill and Inflation Reduction Act both open a gusher of billions and billions of dollars that will flow to industry to capture carbon before it's emitted and store it underground forever. At least that's the plan. EPA seems poised to give states like Louisiana permission to grant these permits on their own, these permits for carbon wells. Well, how does it work? Well, so let's say you have a power plant or a fertilizer plant, and that plant burns fossil fuel, and you don't want to pump all that fossil fuel combustion. You don't want to pump all of that carbon pollution in the air. So the technology would strip out that carbon dioxide before it goes out of the smokestack and otherwise into the atmosphere. And then the industry would take that carbon dioxide, squeeze it into what is called a hypercritical state. That means it's kind of like liquid. And then store tons and tons and tons of this carbon pollution in sedimentary rock in places like Louisiana and Texas. So it'd be going underneath wetlands or in some cases, even underneath the Gulf of Mexico. So I bet you have some questions. And yes, I'm going to take them in order. So first, do we need CCS? The answer is, well, we don't know. Some scenarios that the United Nations has looked at for curbing emissions recommend an ambitious use of CCS. But then there are a lot of scenarios that the UN recognizes that don't require or rely on CCS at all. Your next question, I know, is, does CCS work? And the answer is, we don't know. Over the years, the industry has gotten pretty good at capturing carbon from processed exhaust. But as far as injecting CO2 underground with the intention of storing it for hundreds or thousands of years, well, needless to say, we've never done that before. And there are few facilities in the world, frankly, that are even trying to do that right now. And they're having mixed success as it is. A recent study from the National Academy of Sciences says that bringing CCS to scale in the United States would be, quote, an enormous task. So this leads us to ask, are there any dangers associated with CCS? And here, if we're being honest, the answer has to be yes. There are some dangers to all of this. Sending billions of dollars in subsidies to this technology could prolong the demand for fossil fuel, of course, which is in fact what it's intended to do. That's why the oil and gas industry likes it. This kind of technology could also squander money that would otherwise be spent on replacing coal, oil, and natural gas with new kinds of renewable energy. All that CO2 underground under an awful lot of pressure would also create risks of seismic activity. That means earthquakes. And it could seep into underground aquifers on which people rely for water, too. And it could cause water contamination issues. There's still a lot that we don't know about that. That's a problem for overburdened and underserved communities in the United States, which would probably be the places where this kind of technology is most likely to be located. The other thing that folks in underserved communities want you to know is that they are often the communities that are already getting a lot of pollution from things like oil refineries and fossil fuel plants. And even if you could strip the CO2 out of the exhaust and store it underground successfully, you would still have all of the other gunk that goes into the air, the smog and the soot and so on. And so as opposed to replacing all of that with wind turbines or solar panels, for instance, communities in which these facilities continue to burn fossil fuel would still have to deal with all the other air pollution that they create. So that is my rant today. Take a deep breath, do a down dog or a warrior pose, and now let's go on to the main show. Today, I'm speaking with youth organizer Ada Crandall of Portland, Oregon. Ada Crandall is a 16-year-old organizer with Sunrise Portland Youth and co-lead of the Portland Youth Climate Strike. Her advocacy focuses on the intersection of transportation and climate justice. She got her start in the climate justice space in middle school when she noticed the effects that a nearby freeway was having on some of her classmates. Harriet Tubman Middle School was next to Interstate 5, and that meant that car exhaust and pollution was seeping onto the campus and into the classrooms. Ada and her classmates started an environmental justice club at school and partnered with the organization No More Freeways. Together, they lobbied against a state bill that would fund the highway expansion. She continues her activism today, now in high school, and talked to us about all that she's doing to be a driver of change, as well as the impact that youth can have and do have in their communities. I'd like you to set the scene a little bit, because I'm interested in your work that started back when you were in middle school. What was the moment like that when you decided that you had just had enough of these environmental issues that you were having to deal with?
Growing up, I had always learned this narrative of Portland as being such a green and sustainable and equitable city. And the way that I was taught, it was like, oh yeah, like we're doing our part to stop climate change. Like other places are causing a problem, but here, like we're fine. As I got older, like that narrative very much started to crumble. I started realizing more like the massive systemic level that climate change was. And what really solidified that was going to Harriet Tubman Middle School in 7th and 8th grade. The school is right next to one of the busiest parts of the Interstate 5 freeway. And so my classmates and I, we would walk outside to recess every day and we would see trees and grass and a field. And then right next to it, this massive freeway with tens of thousands of diesel trucks passing the school every single day. But I didn't really grasp yet, like the actual impact that that had on our school, until our teacher, Gerald Scretchens, he was like our social studies teacher. He gathered up this group of students and he started telling us about the health impacts of diesel pollution from the I-5 freeway. And he talked about how this pollution had been linked to asthma and lung cancer, and how we were breathing that pollution every single day at recess, walking and biking to school, waiting for the bus. That was really terrifying. Realizing both the impact of the pollution and also the fact that the Department of Transportation wanted to expand that freeway even further really solidified in my mind the fact that, like, Portland is not the climate leader that we want to present ourselves as.
Tell me a little bit again about your experience in middle school. So you said that you were obviously aware that the freeway's there. You're aware that there's lots of traffic. You can see the trucks. I imagine it must be noisy.
The freeway was pretty much unavoidable. Like, we could hear it, we could see it, we could smell it. It was right there. But then again, like, we were 7th graders. Like, we were thinking about soccer practice and, right, like, our math tests.
Right. And how did you find out that the government was interested in widening the freeway and making the problem even worse?
After we started getting involved in air quality advocacy at the school, like, we had an environmental justice club that went to the Capitol and we lobbied for this bill that would regulate diesel in the state of Oregon. And that bill passed and it felt like this huge victory. And it was like, wow, this is like so great. We've made a really tangible change that's going to like better the lives of future students at our school. And then it sort of felt like a slap in the face.
Tell me a little bit then about how your group and the allies that you're working with, what sort of strategies did you come up with to express your dissatisfaction with all this?
At Tubman Middle School, we formed an environmental justice club who would plan like community sustainability events. We would regularly go to testify at the public hearings for the expansion project and say like, hey, we are students who go to this school. We're being directly impacted by this. We deserve to be heard. After I graduated Tubman, I started working with Sunrise, and I wanted to stay involved in advocating against this freeway project. And so a group of youth in Sunrise founded a campaign called Youth versus ODOT, and we started rallying every other week outside the Oregon Department of Transportation headquarters in downtown Portland. And that sort of like continued pressure really was able to build a lot of momentum.
What was the reaction? Can you tell me? I mean, so there you are, you're protesting. They probably didn't expect you, at least the first time.
I think it is very striking that in a lot of ways, like this group of teenagers standing outside a building every other week with like cardboard protest signs and a megaphone has been able to seriously change the narrative around transportation in Oregon, when the entity that we're up against is like this Department of Transportation that has billions and billions of dollars and like so much money to pour into advertising and PR and like greenwashing and making their things look good. And so even though like none of our specific tangible demands have been met, some of them are literally in the legislature. And then also I think the other side of that is like we really did change the narrative, and like we got people talking about the connection between freeways and climate.
I see. So there were the rallies, and then you as you said, you participated in the hearings, and I suppose that's when you were able to articulate in more detail the particular things that you wanted. Can you tell me a little bit about how you prepared for those hearings, and were they, when you first started, were they what you expected? And I guess I ask this because I've been involved, you know, in hearings on both sides, both sometimes as somebody on a panel and as somebody making comments. And I often notice that there seem to be people who are making comments who are very comfortable with it, who have done it many, many times and sort of understand that system. But then there are people who are doing it for the first time and may not know what to expect.
I was a very shy middle schooler. Like, I was not typically one to speak up in class. I was pretty quiet. Somehow, little introvert me was just, like, totally able to, like, go up there and speak to these bureaucrats and say, like, hey, don't expand a freeway into my school. You know, I was mad and I was scared. I still am. Waking up at 6 a.m. to go, like, testify at obscure government committee hearings is, like, not what I wanted to be doing. But I felt a responsibility to, and like over time, like I've definitely gotten more confident as a speaker.
What sort of support did you get from your family members? What did they think of what you were doing?
I'm really lucky to have a family that is very supportive of the work I do. I think there is a little bit of a, like a generational disconnect between my parents are very sort of like a couple decades ago environmentalists, like recycling. And I'm like, okay, that's great. But also we need to do more than that. And like, they understand that.
Do you think that there's a difference in terms of generation as to how people approach things or about the particular details that they care most about?
Yeah, I think it's really hard even for the most sympathetic adults to understand what it is like to be a teenager today and what it is like to be growing up in this world where we're constantly witnessing like there's like a new crisis in the news every single day. And, you know, our summers are filled with wildfire smoke and heat waves. And we know that like that's the future that we're growing up into. And that's only going to continue to get worse. I've had these conversations with my mom, like talking about what am I going to do in the future? Like, what's my career going to be? And I'm very seriously considering like running for office. And to my mom, that's like completely absurd. And she's like, well, why would you want to do that? Like, I don't want to do that. Like, you have to understand, I don't want to do that. I feel like a responsibility to do that because the people in power aren't stepping up. And so my generation has to, because otherwise it's like the world is literally on fire.
I understand that you are involved in a series of workshops with the PBOT transportation class. Can you tell me, first of all, what PBOT is, and tell me a little bit about these workshops?
PBOT is the Portland Bureau of Transportation. They do an annual class in partnership with Portland State University. Essentially, the class culminated with like everybody pitching a project proposal for something that would improve transportation systems for our communities. And my proposal was a series of workshops to teach middle and high school students how to take public transportation, because it is truly shocking how many people my age literally don't know how to take a bus. And so that's still in the works in terms of actually implementing that.
I wonder, you know, why that is in the U.S. As you know, I'm in New Orleans, and we have actually a pretty good bus system, too, and a streetcar line, a series of streetcar lines. And my neighbors have some friends from Belgium who are staying with them, and their friends have been all over the city using the bus system. And their friends come back at the end of the day and they say, "You've got a great bus system." And they show them even photos they've taken on their phones. And they're like, "You've got a great bus system, but the buses are always empty." And that seems to me like something I have seen in many American cities that I've lived in. Why do you think that is?
A lot of it comes down to just like, oftentimes, if people have access to a car, it is like objectively easier to drive in a lot of situations because, yeah, the bus is infrequent. It takes a really long time. Our society has made cars this sort of like superior option that's so glorified. Mm-hmm. And it's also like, in a lot of ways, like a symbol of class. Being able to get where you need to go shouldn't be something that's only available to like people who have enough money to buy and maintain a vehicle.
Do you think that people in your generation are more, I don't know, are they more imaginative? I mean, in the sense that, you know, someone like me, I ride the bus sometimes, not very much, I have to say. I do ride my bike to school, you know, about half the time. But there's sometimes I feel like I get myself into ruts where if I'm driving or, you know, something like that, I just don't imagine that I should be doing or could be doing anything else to get to work or somewhere else.
People have it, especially older people, have it very deeply ingrained in their minds that like cars, like driving, like so great. And I think that's starting to change, especially as momentum picks up in the climate movement and realizing like we need to overhaul every aspect of our society to meet the stakes of the climate crisis. And transportation is one of those things. Like, in a future where we have a Green New Deal, we have climate justice, we're not going to be driving around these like single occupancy, massive polluting boxes of metal. It's just like not a thing that's going to happen.
Do you have a driver's license?
I don't.
You don't? Okay. And you're 16, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I have three adult sons now, and two of them went years after they were 16 years old before they ever got a driver's license. And one doesn't really drive that much at all, you know, even today, which is so different from, you know, when I got my driver's license. That was the thing you did. I got it on my 16th birthday.
That's the thing. Like, our society glorifies driving so much. And the driver's license is seen as essentially a ticket to independence, a ticket to
that's exactly
being able
right.
to get where you need to go. And I see that especially like amongst my high school, which is predominantly white, like very affluent.
There seems to be a larger prevalence of depression, of anxiety, of uncertainty. And there's quite a bit of debate about why that might be. And obviously, that's not everyone. And there are plenty of people like you who are just, you know, very active, very tuned into things that are going on. But I do worry about people who might be feeling bad about things or maybe even just giving up. And I'm wondering why you think that is.
There's a lot of pressure on young people today. And it is, yeah, really easy to feel like to fall into just like giving up. And I definitely grapple a lot with like, is the work that I'm doing worth it? Can we stop the climate crisis? To a certain point, like I have to have some level of hope to be able to continue doing this work. And like, yes, a lot of my organizing is driven by fear and by this like really deep existential panic of like, this is the future of the world and like nobody's doing anything about it. And like you can feel really helpless and kind of betrayed by leaders and past generations. there's so much pressure on us in a way that older generations don't really understand.
What inspires you? You might feel this anxiety sometimes, but what keeps you going?
I'm definitely really inspired constantly by the people around me. And I've found such a powerful community in climate organizing of people who I really feel like share my values and have my back and are there to support me. And that has been incredible. Like to have people who, yeah, are there with me at like the most exciting victories when we feel like, yeah, we're on the top of the world, we're gonna win, we're building power. And also at the times where everything feels hopeless and it's like, why are we even doing this? This is so hard.
One thing that's very interesting. So my father-in-law, he's Danish and he's in his late 90s. When he was your age, he lived in a country that was occupied by the Nazis, right, during World War II. I find it so interesting to talk to him because he's somebody who, even at that time, wasn't giving up. Right. Living in an occupied country during a war and had, you know, dreams of things that he wanted to do and things that he wanted to be. And he was able to accomplish much of that. And because he just never gave up and he knew other people like him who were the same. Right. And they could share their fears and anxieties, which they had plenty of at the time. Everybody grows up in a different time. But it is interesting that my experience, people are inspired by being with people, doing things together, having some kind of a plan. What do you think you have hope about in the future?
Well, one thing is like seeing some of the original youth ODOT demands be translated into actual policy this legislative session definitely is a good reminder that the work that we're doing does make an impact and that we are starting to change things. It's not only a sad story. Like there have always been people who are standing up against these injustices. There have always been activists and organizers and people helping their communities and doing mutual aid work. And like, for example, freeway expansion proposals in Portland have been stopped before by community organizers. And it can happen again if we tell those stories and if we make people realize that like social movements have so much power. Social movements can transform our society. And also sort of on a different note, something I'm working on right now is with Sunrise Movement at a national level organizing the Green New Deal for Schools campaign. About 30 students from all over the country came together in Philadelphia, and we had this big training about organizing theory and what Sunrise is and how Sunrise is fighting for a Green New Deal and how students can organize in their schools. And so now all 30 of these students from like 12 different schools are taking this campaign back to their schools, and they're going to start organizing their peers to win a Green New Deal for their community. Like being able to teach other organizers how to gain these skills and like how to get into this work really gives me a lot of energy and motivation. This group of people that is all over the country, like organizing in drastically different school contexts, all of them are united under this really shared vision. I'm fighting to stop freeway expansions in Portland, but also in like every other city and every other place, there are other young people who have all of these shared values to me who are fighting for this same vision of a better world. And so keeping that in mind really gives me a lot of energy to keep fighting.
Well, thank you very much, Ada, for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information, visit us at progressivereform.org or follow us on Instagram at progressivereform, all one word, or catch up with us on Twitter at CPRblog, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and don't forget to leave us a review. It helps us to reach more listeners like you who want to connect the dots on today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guest today, Ada Crandall, as well as our producer, Maggie DeWayne, and our editor, Courtney Garcia. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.